Chapter 42. Ludendorff at the Gates. Where was France at the end of 1917? This was the question André Tardieu would ask in his book, Peace. Tardieu had been a relentless propagandist for Pan-Slavism at the beginning of the war and would later become president of the Council of Ministers of France. Tardieu answered his own question unequivocally. The reverse of April, 1917 created among a number of people a desire for immediate peace. There was mutiny at the front, defeatism in the rear lines, and treason on the march. Romania had delivered its wheat and oil to the enemy. Lenin's rise to power had sent hundreds of German battalions against us. American war preparations were particularly slow. Our armies were immobilized by lack of gasoline. The British had suffered the disaster of March, 1918, and the French had suffered an equal disaster at the Chemin des Dames. The Germans were on the Marne and Paris was being bombed. Confidence in the French head of government was low, and it was said in the House that he was losing the war. On September 29, 1919, Clemenceau publicly revealed a bitter exchange he had had with British Prime Minister Lloyd George. "Lloyd George, do you recognize that without the British Navy you could not have carried on the war?" Clemenceau, "Yes." American oil shipments to France prevented a collapse of the war effort. Tardieu, sent by Clemenceau to the United States, has given some telling figures. "If I had not succeeded at the beginning of 1918 in obtaining from President Wilson the massive help which raised our petroleum reserves from 47,000 tons on February 1 to 237,000 tons by April 30, the two battles, one defensive and the other offensive, which decided victory would not have been won. How would Ludendorff first win, then lose these battles, which the French would have lost without American oil and the British Navy?" First-hand witnesses like Clemenceau and his military aide, General Mordack, offered the best record of France's near collapse and Germany's brush with victory. General Mordack's record of events, on a daily basis, has been acknowledged as factual by most historians. On March 21, 1918, at 9 in the morning, the British were under attack at St. Quentin. For 5 hours, they had been relentlessly pounded by Ludendorff's 90 divisions. Then General Hutier, who the previous year had conquered Riga, threw in the 18th German Army. Within hours the British front had collapsed and the British retreated in panic. The Allied front line had been breached. General von Marwitz's 2nd Army and General von Billow's 16th followed suit. "Within 48 hours, wrote Renouvin, the British were retreating in a rout. Clemenceau was informed by the military on April 25 that British, General Haig would have to capitulate before 2 weeks and that the French army would be lucky if it could do the same. Clemenceau, Greatness and Misery of Victory, page 22. "France is in supreme danger. The British are running for the North Sea to get home. Haig has no more reserve troops and England cannot provide men for immediate combat duty," Clemenceau, page 25. The Germans had opened up a major breach exactly at the junction of the British and French armies, which were split in two. Both could think only of saving their own hides. The British priority was to cover their escape routes, namely the channel ports of the North Sea, and the French strove to defend Paris. Marshal Foch himself said, "Ludendorff's divisions have just swung open both halves of the door." French ministers met in haste with the generals in Doullens. French President Poincaré was brought in for appearances' sake, but now it was Clemenceau who was in command. He offered the British reinforcements on the condition they would accept General Foch as supreme commander of all Allied forces. The British objected at first, but events would soon change their minds. Ludendorff fanned out his troops from southwest to northwest. Hutier reached Montdidier. The Allies had a brief respite when some of Hutier's divisions arrived late from the Russian front. The Allied losses were enormous. 90,000 French and British soldiers were taken prisoner. On April 3, 1918, the British were forced to accept Foch's leadership. Their acceptance was only tactical, and only for the purpose of securing more French troops to cover their retreat. Foch's actual recognition as commanding general of Allied forces only came on April 17, 1918, when the British were hit by Ludendorff's second offensive. The second offensive began on April 8, 1918 between Armentières and La Bassée. The 6th German Army's 36 divisions crossed the River Lys and annihilated two Portuguese divisions which had bogged down in the mud of Flanders. The Germans seized Kemmelberg, the highest hill of the region, on April 25, 1918. This was a ploy to draw French divisions away from the main front. After the Allies fell into the trap, Ludendorff then applied maximum pressure against the weakened Allied front. While Ludendorff prepared for the next thrust, he had to deal with the scarcity of munitions and supplies. Austrian and German soldiers had to live on a ration of 34 grams of meat, 14 grams of fat and 165 grams of bread per day. Supply convoys were critically short of gas and horses. Yet the Germans still managed to deliver two major consecutive blows against the British. Clemenceau wrote, "I just saw one of the last British contingents. Its sorry state was proof that our excellent ally was on its last legs." Clemenceau, page 47. At the conference of Abbeville on May 2, 1918, Foch was just as alarmed. "The last enemy offensive brought losses of men and material out of all proportion to the losses of the last 3 years. British infantry suffered greater casualties than they ever have before. The French suffered similar losses, and it is inevitable that worse is to come." Clemenceau was stunned when the British decided to cut their losses and let go of 9 divisions. The loss of 200,000 men in March 1918 was more than they could stand. The move almost triggered a fist fight between Lloyd George and Clemenceau. Foch admitted, "The outcome of the war now depends on the success of an enemy offensive at certain locations." Both Britain and France were demoralized. The French socialist boss Marion was already conceding defeat, "We are in the position of losers." Even Tardieu, the flamboyant warmonger, had grown gloomy, "General Gough's British army broken and thrown back on Amiens." The March 23 German bombing of Paris and the rupture of the Anglo-French front brought us back to the worst hours of 1914. Ludendorff concentrated his third offensive against the French. The shock was such that only the redeployment of French troops from Flanders saved France from collapse. The battle took place at Chemin des Dames and soon became a bloodbath. Bodies piled up in mountains, 422,000 French soldiers were killed, almost a third of France's casualties for the entire war. On May 27, 1918, the Kronprinz, the German Crown Prince, ordered 30 divisions to take the offensive along a 30-mile front. The objective was to penetrate French lines to a depth of 15 miles and reach their munition and supplies depots. The offensive was successful beyond expectations. After the Chemin des Dames catastrophe, the rupture of the French front, our troops have been thrown back to the Marne River. Tardieu, Pix, page 46. The French lost another 160,000 men. The Germans took 50,000 prisoners. On May 29 Soissons fell, and on May 31 the Germans took Dormans and Château Thierry after crossing the Marne. Ludendorff was within an hour's drive of Paris. The most important witness to this debacle was General Mordack, who reported directly to Clemenceau. May 27, 1918, Chemin des Dames, supposedly an impregnable fortress, fell without resistance at the first German thrust. The bridges of the Aisne River were taken, and to this day we were still trying to find out how. May 28, Fism fell and the Germans reached Soissons after taking a considerable number of prisoners. There is great emotion in Paris. May 29 and 30, the Germans take Soissons, cross the Arlette River and reach the Marne on the 30th. May 31, June 1, the Germans control the Marne from Dormans to Château Thierry. The German offensive had advanced 3 times further than expected by Ludendorff himself. It took incredible French efforts to stem the tide. General Mordack concluded, "During the Battle of the Chemin des Dames, the Allies lost 60,000 prisoners, 700 cannon, 2,000 machine guns, a large amount of artillery and air force material, major depots of munitions, supplies and food. The railway, so vital to supply Chalons from Paris, was no longer usable. It was a disaster. The general did not even mention the enormous number of dead and wounded. As if that weren't enough, the Germans had launched a fourth offensive in the direction of Compiègne. Here again, General Mordack has left some invaluable notes. May 28, General Duchesne visits the Belleau headquarters. He is in command of the 6th Army and he has retreated to Auchy-le-Château. The Germans are advancing and we have nothing to oppose them. Duchesne is complaining that since the beginning of the offensive he has not seen any great leader emerging. We are sleeping the night at Provins, headquarters of General Pétain, who criticizes Foch for having sent the reserves to the north of France and to the Somme River. He has been totally opposed to it. He said the divisions were badly deployed and the artillery had failed. On May 29, we just escaped the Germans on our way to Perrentardainois. At Fresnes, General Degout informs us that divisions had been thrown into battle without any artillery support. It is a tragic sight to see the general poring over tattered maps while couriers on motorcycles keep arriving announcing the advance of the enemy. I left him knowing I would never see him again. It is one of the most heartrending memories I have of this war. We are returning to Paris. The situation is confused. The House of Deputies is in a panic. On June 14, 1918, the House of Deputies was crawling with cowards and conspirators. There were motions to punish those responsible for the debacle. Clemenceau fought like a tiger to save his defeated generals. If I had given way a single minute, he said, the whole high command would have gone. And General Foch would have been the first to go. Said Clemenceau, I do not boast when I say I saved him. Without this irascible old man of 76 years, often rude and with a cloudy political past, France would very likely have collapsed by mid-June of 1918. As with all drowning democracies, it took a strong man to save France. Clemenceau was that strong man, tireless and intractable. Former German Chancellor Prince von Bülow wrote, as in the days of the convention, leaders emerged to handle the crisis. Clemenceau, with a scarf wrapped around his neck, a rumpled old hat on his head and a walrus mustache, ran from crisis to crisis, firing the incompetents and raising the morale of the exhausted and dispirited soldiers. Germany did not have such an asset. Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg was a cultivated man but out of his depth in politics. Sad and uninspiring, he had muddled through blunder after blunder. As early as 1914, he had lost all credibility and was unable to conduct serious negotiations. The Kaiser fired him in July 1917 and a new chancellor, George Michaelis, was appointed. The new minister proved himself totally incompetent and only lasted 3 months. His successor was Count von Hertling, well-meaning but also inept. He was a sickly academic and a priest was always on call to give him the last rites. Hertling somehow survived politically for 12 months. He was then replaced by Prince Max of Baden, an amiable man of wholly liberal thinking, who was overwhelmed by the position and resigned 3 months later. None of these men were a match for the formidable Clemenceau. They dissipated German military gains with turgid politics. Clemenceau, on the other hand, was thundering his way out of defeat. I am presenting myself to you, he roared to French deputies, with only one thought, total war. All defeatists will be court-martialed. There will be no more peace campaigns or demonstrations, there will be no more treason, no more half-treason. My program is the same everywhere, I wage war at home, I wage war outside. I will continue the war until the last minute, because the last minute will be ours. Germany might have been imperial, but somehow traitors were tolerated. While Clemenceau turned the firing squad on the slightest traitor, German traitors were left to undermine national resolve. Socialist congressmen declared with impunity, "We will sabotage the German army in order to start world revolution." Socialist congressman Strobel declared that a German victory would be contrary to socialist interests. Former Chancellor von Bülow wrote, "There were many traitors to the nation among our socialists, while there were none among the French, the British, Italian, or Belgian socialists." Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, the communist Jewish agitators who were instigating riots in Berlin for the purpose of overthrowing the German government at the end of the war, announced, "The revolution will start as soon as the military situation worsens." The imperial government not only did not punish the traitors, but it did nothing to back or encourage those socialists who were loyal and patriotic. Communist saboteurs were allowed to disrupt war factories and push their propaganda on the workers, a situation which no other country tolerated. Von Bülow noted the difference. French law punished to the utmost propagators of pacifism and defeatism. The editor of the socialist and pacifist paper Bonnet Rouge was arrested and put to death a few days later. Interior Minister Malvy was fired and exiled in disgrace because he was accused of being soft on pacifism. Former Foreign Minister Kalos was jailed as a defeatist and barely escaped with his life. The Egyptian banker Bilal Pasha was arrested for corruption with Germany and for pacifism. The charge was groundless, but he was nevertheless court-martialed and executed 24 hours later at Vincennes. Pompous declarations about liberty and fraternity just made Clemenceau laugh. "Woe to the weak! Shun all who would put you to sleep. We are at the height of an implacable war of domination." Clemenceau committed excesses and injustices, but they were based on the unshakable conviction that nothing could stand in the way of the war effort. Clemenceau's ruthlessness came just in time. Ludendorff was almost at the gates of Paris, and the French authorities were preparing to flee south, just as in 1914. Clemenceau had somehow single-handedly managed to stem the panic and re-establish order. Despite its outstanding success on the battlefront, Germany was still short of victory. Hindenburg had hundreds of thousands of troops in Russia and Ukraine, which were now essential if Germany was to win the war. The troops were left there to ensure the delivery of wheat to Austria and Germany. 40 other divisions had also been forced to remain between Kiev and Riga in case Lenin should suddenly break the Brest-Litovsk Treaty. Ludendorff desperately needed these divisions. His military genius could not offset their absence forever.